For the Orleans County Historical Association, February 24, 1981, Helen McAllister of Medina, New York, is interviewing Mr. Wesley Heitz, H-E-I-T-Z, of 147 Maple Avenue, Medina, New York. Wes, would you please tell us when you were born and where?
I was born in 1903 in Henrietta, New York.
What was your father's name?
Bert. Bert Albert, but they called him Bert Albert.
Okay, and your mother's maiden name?
Was Jenny.
Jenny what?
Gangross.
Okay, her real name was Carolyn, wasn't it?
Yes.
But they called her Jenny. Did you have any brothers or sisters?
I have a sister, Bessie.
Mm-hmm. I believe that you've said that your ancestors were really formed the melting pot for America. Would you want to tell us where they came from?
Well, my grandpa Heitz came from Germany. And my grandma Heitz came from Ireland. And she came over as she worked her way, and she had to pay her passage by working it out after she got here.
Is that what they call an indentured servant?
Well, or serf, or whatever you might call it.
Just about. Did you have anybody from Holland?
My grandfather, Gangross, which was my mother's father, mm-hmm. he came from Holland.
Mm-hmm. And what?
My mother's mother was a Connecticut Yankee.
Well, how about your grandfather? Didn't he shake hands with President Lincoln?
Oh, yeah.
Would you tell us about that?
Down in Gettysburg. He was in the 2nd New York Cavalry, and they dismounted at Gettysburg and put him on foot. So when Pickett, was, they expected him to come around the end, and when he come around, he ran right into him.
Now, who was this that came around?
Pickett from the south.
I see. And what did he do when he ran right into him?
Well, they stopped him there.
Uh-huh.
And then he was, he was in the army because he took the place of three businessmen. They equipped him and sent him.
Who was this?
My grandpa, mm-hmm. Heitz.
Grandfather Heitz, yes.
Yeah, and they sent him in their place so you could equip a man and send him. Mm-hmm. And he was in. Mm-hmm. And, but he, he didn't get his discharge papers till, I was looking at him the other day, 1892. Mm-hmm. He was in the Gettysburg battle, but they mustered him out, but they never gave him the papers to, mm-hmm. so all that time after.
Flag. Mm-hmm.
He carried the American flag.
Where is that flag now?
In Albany.
In the museum down there?
Yeah, right in the vestibule of the Capitol building.
Wes, what did your father do for a living? Was he a baker?
Yeah, well, he'd done two or three different things. He was a baker, he was a farmer, and he was a piano finisher, the varnish and polish the outside on a piano.
Mm-hmm. Was this in Rochester for the most part?
East Rochester in the, mm-hmm. I think it was Foster Armstrong Piano Company in East Rochester.
Mm-hmm. And he had a bakery at one time in Holly, didn't he?
Well, his uncle, Willie Dietz was his uncle's name, and he learned the trade from his uncle in Holly. Mm-hmm. And they had to go through the routine of learning from the broom up.
From the broom on up?
Yes. Sweeping the floor till I could learn to be a baker.
Yes. Well, you started life in Rochester.
That's right.
And I believe you've told me that when you were in approximately the third grade, there was a smallpox epidemic.
Well, that was, no, that was the smallpox epidemic was before that, few years. But I was taken sick in the third, when I was in the third grade. And I was out of school for 4 years. And
now, I believe that this illness that took you out of school was related to the smallpox epidemic
that you left
that area, is that right?
No, the idea was that the doctor I had for the trouble I had, which I don't really know what it was for sure, the doctor called to Rochester on account of that smallpox epidemic. Mm-hmm. And he was the doctor that got me back on my feet because they only gave me 6 months to live at that time.
Well, somewhere along the line, you've said that you went to live in the Montezuma Swamp.
When was that? I was down in Savannah, New York, and in summer vacation from school, and I had an aunt down there, and I had Aunt Nellie, her name was, and they had diphtheria in Savannah. So, in order for me to get back from there to Rochester, they took me out of the village of Savannah, and we camped down in the Montezuma Swamps until my folks could come down and get me.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that helped bring on some rheumatism?
Well, it could have been a big factor in the deal. Mm-hmm.
And you were ill for 4 years?
I was out of school for 4 years. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How did they treat you? How did the doctor treat you?
Well, he was one of these herb doctors, I called it, because you never went to the drugstore for medicine. He made the medicine right there out of, and it didn't taste too good, but I took what he gave me and all the time, and I started to get better.
It must have worked.
I wouldn't have been here.
Right.
At least I had 70 years, because it was seven. I was 7 years old, better. So I cheated them. I got 70 more years.
Right. Eventually, your father moved to Middleport, didn't he? Or
to run the bakery. Mm-hmm. And we were there. 10 years or better.
Mm-hmm. What bakery did he buy out?
Well, he didn't buy a bakery. It was empty. The building was empty. Billy Bosch owned the building.
I see.
And we rented the building and bought the equipment and started the bakery. Mm-hmm. And
did you deliver things from the bakery?
Oh, we had four or five trucks on the road. And would go out in the routes. Each one had, every other day they went on a different route.
Mm-hmm. How far would they go?
Well, I myself drove one down through Gaines and up through the back country here. Mm-hmm. And the others went to Wilkesville and back, and some went way down the Hess Road and the Kyman Road and down north. And
how did you know where you should stop?
Well, we had cards with H on them. Mm-hmm. And we had regular customers that would, you had that stop every time you come by. Mm-hmm. But if anybody else on that route wanted something from you, they put this card in the window and you look up, you'd see it on the drive of the truck and you'd pull in. Mm-hmm. If they didn't want anything, the next time they took it down, you didn't stop.
Now, about this time, you were drafted for World War I, weren't you? Or you were called upon?
Oh, that was before I ever came to Middleport.
Okay, tell us about that.
Well, I was in Rochester. I didn't even know I was supposed to be connected with it, but I was getting to be about that age, see. Mm-hmm. So when I moved out of Rochester, I just moved out with my mother and father and moved to Middleport. Then I got a letter from the War Department. I had to go back to Rochester, and they told me I did wrong by leaving and not notifying. Mm-hmm. That's the first time I knew I had any connection with World War I. So I had to find it the hard way. So they.
What happened? Were you drafted?
Well, they balled me out for not letting them know that I moved out of Rochester, see. Mm-hmm. And that was the end of that. But it had me scared. A big red letter with black, a big red envelope with black letters on it, you know, and I looked at it, that's it.
But then the war ended.
It ended before I moved out of Rochester.
Oh, and you still had to report?
Yeah, it was in 1919 I moved out of Rochester. I couldn't figure that out. The war was over. But I was still, they must have had a finger on me somewhere.
Somewhere along in here you had a car, a Ford Coupe, your first car?
Model T Ford, yeah, 1922. And that's when I started getting around. I went all around with that. And I wrecked it once.
How did you do that?
I don't know. I'd been in Binghamton. There'd been four of us together, two girls and two of us fellas, that went to Binghamton down this St. Bonaventure College. We went down there. Come back and let the girls out in Lockport because I was going with them. Come down and I got pretty near the gas port when all of a sudden, bang, I must have fell asleep or something. Mm. The car jumped over a fence and never knocked it down. Mm. And I was standing up, but the car was laying on its side and there was no body on it. The seat was on my back under the steering column. And my feet was on the ground, my head was sticking out the other side. And when I went to come back to get over the fence, I tore my suit because there was a strand of barbed wire along the top of the farm fence. And I got out, somebody come along, picked me up and took me home.
Were you alone at that time?
Yeah, I was all alone.
I see. Well, that was lucky that you... That you were alone and that nobody else got hurt, or that you didn't.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't suppose you had car insurance at that time.
Oh, no. No, nobody had no insurance. Mm. Didn't have to have it either.
So that was a total loss?
No, all I did, I went up the next morning and put one new wheel on the back of the car, the Ford. We tipped it back up on the wheels. I got in and started it. Filled up, but the body was all gone. The body was just like nothing. Filled it back down, and in 3 days I had the new body from the Ford factory in Buffalo on Main Street.
Did they send you the parts or what?
No, I went up with a farm truck, a Model T farm truck, and went in the factory and up on the elevator and backed up to the body department. They put this coupe body on, Model T coupe body on the truck. I come back, come home that night. I was working in the Ford garage at that time. And all the fellas that worked there helped me. We took the body and put it on the thing and it was like new again.
Well, you were pretty lucky. Oh, dear. Well, somewhere along in here you were a state trooper.
Just shortly.
You have to take training for that?
Oh, yeah. I was there about 4 or 5 weeks on training at that time. Of course, that's probably changed now. Mm-hmm. But they wanted to send me one place and a fellow that went in training with me and to another. And we had decided that I wanted to go where he was going to be sent and he wanted to go where I was going to be sent. So Cap Robinson over there in Batavia, and he was surly sort of a guy. Mm-hmm. We went in to talk to him, and he says, "You're going to do as I tell you, and I'm sending you where I'm telling you, and you're going where I tell you." And I says, I got one more chance in a soldier, I can quit. And that was it.
And that was it. Well, before you had an automobile, I think you were telling me about taking a trolley to Albion to date the girls.
Oh, yeah, we had a lot of trolley rides. Boy, it cost you a dime to go here and a quarter to go there. We used to get on the trolley and go down to Albion. There was a corner, well, it's a corner drugstore now, but it was an ice cream parlor then, which them days we hung around the ice cream parlors.
Sure.
We didn't. And the fellas in Albion didn't want the guys from out of town coming in to see their girls, so we used to get in a little tussle here and there. And we used to, well, if there was too many, we'd run. And about the last trolley going through, and they used to tease us a little on that trolley with the motorman and the conductor. And I got the idea to run up and back of the trolley if I could just about reach it and pull the trolley pole off, and they couldn't go. They lost the electricity. And while he was out putting the trolley pole back on the wire, we'd get in and away we go with him. So.
Did you sometimes take the trolley down to Alcott for a dance?
No, my wife did, though.
Your wife did?
Yeah.
Tell me about the dances, 10-cent dances, or whatever you call them.
Oh, they're down in Chattagy, the Diamond Dance. Yeah, they had that. That was, Raz Boyd run that, and he had a partner in it. Do you remember? And they had, well, it was every night they danced. Mm-hmm. If you had some money, you'd go down and you'd dance. And
what were the tickets like?
Regular picture show tickets, a little stub.
You get them one at a time or a whole string of them?
Well, it all depended on how much money you had.
I was
you bought. If we thought we'd stay for half a dozen dances, we'd get a half a dozen tickets. Mm-hmm. If we didn't, we'd only get what we wanted. We'd look the crowd over and buy tickets according to the who was there we knew.
Now, did you take your girls there, your girlfriends there, or did you go and meet your girl there?
No, we usually took a girl with us when we went. Mm-hmm. Like one time with her, I went down with another girl, with Helen, and she was down there. And she walked over and she says, give me some tickets, I want to dance.
Now, who is this?
My wife.
Oh, your wife, Helen, yes.
Well, so, I tore off so many tickets and handed them to her.
Tell me how you met the woman who became your wife.
Well, down at Alcott Beach.
You met her at Alcott Beach.
Yeah. And I used to go down, take another fella down. He went down to see this girl, Muggs Hoy. And I went down and go to the picture show. And then after the picture show was over, they'd meet me and walk down. They come met me one night at the show, and there was my friend and his girl and another girl. They walked down to Jake Aldridge's dance hall, which was quite a place at that time. And they turned in to go to the dance, and I turned and went over to the car and waited until he come out. And then the next night I went down and took him down because I had the car, and there were always somebody wanting to go here or there. I went to the show again, come out, and there they stood, the two of them, but they didn't have no girl for me. So they says, well, come on down. Mug says, there's a lot of girls from the shirt factory down here on a vacation. And sure, there must be one in there that you could. So I says, okay, come in. I went down, went in, I looked, and I looked over, and I says to Muggs, that one. So
that, now, am I right that she had her back to you at that time?
She had her back. I says, that's that one there. And she went over and got her, brought her out, and introduced me to her, and we danced, and we took them down to the cottage where they were staying. We come home, and before I left, I said, can I see you tomorrow night? She said, well, if you want to. So I went back.
And you've been seeing her ever since. Now, your wife's name was Helen Gray,
right?
And she worked at Newell's Shirt Factory. Yeah. I believe that you said that she had a sister, Bernice?
Jerry. Well, she had two sisters, Bernice and Jerry.
And Jerry.
Yeah.
Who did Bernice marry?
Louis Capella.
Mm-hmm. And she had a child?
Yeah, the Sandy.
Two.
Oh, two. Cheryl and Sandy.
Mm-hmm.
And when I left Middle Point, got through with the bakery during the Depression in the 30s,
mm-hmm.
I went to live with Bernice and Louis. And Cheryl was there.
Mm-hmm.
And I lived, 3 years with them, and then finally we got married. But I went with her for 10 years before we got married.
Mm-hmm. You went with Helen 10 years before you got married?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I believe you said that when Bernice died, that you and your wife were able to help out there?
Oh, well, we helped out when Louis and Bernice were both alive. We helped them as much as we could. And Bernice died first, and she asked us if we'd take Sandy because we said yes. So then, when Louis got sick, or Sandy's father, we took him up to our house and kept him until he had to go to Buffalo, and then he died.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked us the same question, would we take Sandy? So we did.
Mm-hmm.
So Sandy was 10 years old, and we took her and raised her from there.
She has, she married a man by the name of Baker.
Ronald Baker, yeah.
Ron Baker.
And Shelby.
And he died much too soon.
Oh yes, he had been in the Korean War. He went through that, got out, and then they got married, and they were treating him for cholesterol.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of that, the artery that was supposed to be to go in his heart wasn't any bigger than a vein,
mm-hmm.
and they were treating him for cholesterol. Well, one day going to work, he would. Got up by the wick wire up there in west of Middleport, and he says to his fellow was riding with him, you drive, I don't feel good. And he got out, walked around the car, got in, sat down, and boom.
Was gone. He was 29.
Yeah.
Since then, Sandy has remarried.
Oh, yeah.
To
Ace Caldwell.
Mm-hmm. Ace Caldwell, what's his name? His real name is
Waldo.
Waldo. Well, I think she was very fortunate to have had you folks. What about her sister? You said there was a sister?
Yeah, Cheryl. Well, Cheryl was sort of, well, she got married.
She was older, so
oh,
she,
yeah, she was 18 years.
I see. One thing that I think you told me when you were going with the woman who became your wife, was it your father that
yes.
made a real good statement? What did he say when he met Helen?
Well, I went with her quite a while. I'd come down here, and
mm-hmm.
finally I decided it was time to bring her home and show her to my folks. And so my dad was over working in the bakery cleaning up on a Sunday morning, and I'd brought Helen up to the house and introduced her to my mother, and my father come in, and then I introduced her to him, and he looked at her and walked around, and he took a hold of her arm, and he says to her, now you're a nice corn-fed mama, what's your intentions towards my son? She could have killed him.
Oh dear. You were married in 1933.
Right.
Were you married in Medina?
Yes, at the parsonage at the Baptist Church. Mm-hmm. We had quite a bit of loot after we got married. We come out to the car. We had a 50-pound cake of ice, a bucket of coal, and a bottle of milk.
Why did you have that?
Well, one, the coal dealer and the milk dealer and the ice man. That was all those, they was there on the outside waiting when we come out of the parsonage. And they put it in the car.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Well, when you were married in 1933, where were you working, Wes?
I was working with an outfit with John Foster from Medina owned it, run it. And they called it the Red Seal Service. Mm-hmm. It was drawing gasoline out of Pennsylvania by a semi-trailer. And on this semi-trailer deal, I was the first one to drive one in this part of the country at that time. The only other one that was anywhere near like it was out of Buffalo. Mm-hmm. And the guys from it was a Chevrolet, a truck that was pulling the semi-trailer deal, and they used to send guys out of General Motors, even from Detroit, to ride with me to see how it acted. And some of them wouldn't even ride across the bridge or up a hill. They'd get out and walk.
You were the one that got the last paycheck there, is that right?
Well, this was another, after I went and got through with Foster, I went running a garage in, under Medina Parts, and we sold the Graham car, my partner and I, which was Louis Capella's brother, Joe Capella. We sold cars there for 2-3 years, and there was a Dr. Jackson, he bought 3 one year, he wrecked 2.
What kind of car did you sell?
The Graham.
The Graham.
Yeah, it was they call it a Graham Supercharger. It got good mileage, very good.
With Joe Capella, where were you located?
And under Medina Parts, down the hill.
Where Case's wallpaper is in that area?
That's right. We had that whole cellar part, as they called it. The old jail was in there, and then it went way back under the street.
When you say the old jail, tell me about that. What do you mean?
Oh, and that's where the years ago they had the police station there too, instead of the city hall where it is now. And they, those cells they had down there was still there when we was there, and we used to go back and look at them. And it was very small. I don't know how anybody ever fit in them, but they. And then we done a lot of repair work there, even for Pajak. He didn't have a repair department of his own, so he sent all his Chevrolets down there to have them serviced for delivery. And we washed them and got them all ready to go for Johnny Pajak.
Did you only work on the Graham car?
Oh, no, we worked on every car. We worked on the Chevrolets and anything. Studebakers at that time and Franklin's, they had the air-cooled engine car. And any car that came in, we worked on it.
How long were you in partnership with Mr. Capella?
Oh, and it's a couple of years, I think, until.
Did you say you were a silent partner?
Yeah, my name didn't carry on the thing. It was Joe Capella's garage, but I was in with him. And in other words, I had the Graham car was my car.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean when you say your car?
Well, we had a demonstrator, and I bought it. It was my car at that time. And we demonstrated and sold cars from that, you know.
At one time, didn't you work for the Maxwell Petroleum Company of Buffalo?
Yes, that's when I got kind of tired of doing all the work in the garage down Medina Parts, and Lee Skinner come along one day up the house, and he says to me, "Wes, I got a good job for you up in Buffalo." I says, "You have?" He says, "Yes." "What is it?" He says, "Just what you used to do, driving a gasoline truck." So I went up and seen this man that was supposed to be the head guy from the stockholders organization, and talked with him, and I went to work right away. That is, the next day, that was on a weekend. I went on Monday. I worked for the Maxwell Petroleum, they called it, and that consists of. Well, it was Justin Roberts, Howard Vinson, and
Mr. Grinnell?
Claude Grinnell, and there was Katie Lacey and Charlie Hawks and Medina Parts, and I worked there until, it kind of faded out, and I was the last one to draw a paycheck from that company.
Is this the time that you were driving when you were carrying lots of money?
Oh yes, I had a lot of money taken into Buffalo every now and then from, Claude Grinnell was the treasurer of it. And
how did you carry the money? Was it a check?
No, not at first. It was put in I had a big white envelope, and they'd bring it over. I lived right across from Claude Grinnell on Park Avenue. He'd bring it over and ring the doorbell. I'd go down, he'd say, "Here, Wes, take this up with you in the morning." So I did that, and I'd take it upstairs, and I'd throw it where I had my work clothes, where my shoes was. I'd throw it on the floor, never give it a thought.
Did you know what you had?
Not at the time when it started. Until one day I stood there after I delivered it in Buffalo, and he opened this Mitch Smith opened the envelope, took out all this money, and I decided then and there that was the last cash I was going to carry. So I went back and refused to take any cash. I says, "From now on, it's going to be a check."
That would protect you.
Well, he could have said at any time, "I didn't get this $20,000 or whatever it was.
$20,000. Was it before or after this time that you did that for about 3 years, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, yeah.
And was it before or after this time that you worked for the S.A. Cook Company?
I worked for S.A. Cook Company when I first came to Medina in 1930. I worked there, and I worked up in the erecting room, making Davenport frames and chairs and frames. And then I would, in the summertime, I'd go down the lake and I'd work for Claude Hull I can't think of his name. Well, anyways, the bunch of the cooks and I'd work down around the cottage with the little dump truck they had there and grade the lawn and stuff like that. Then in the wintertime, I go back up in the factory. Well, seems like one of the stockholders was kicking because I was working all the time, and Rowland Howell came to me one day and he says, "Wes, I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to lay off." He says, But the guy, the ones that's making all the trouble, he says, that's all right. He says, if you ever want another job, or ever want a job, and he says, we're in business, he says, you come to us, and he says, I'll make a room for you. But I never went back. I went out and got another job.
When you got through with S.A. Cook, then did you have trouble finding a job or not? It was in the middle of the Depression.
Well, yes, there wasn't too much work, so boarding with Louis Capella, he had this automobile paint shop, and I used to go over there and do a little, help him a little to help pay my room and board.
Where was that located?
Worthy and Mead. Yeah.
Well, during the Depression, how could people afford to get their cars painted?
Well, this was mostly dealers. It was a $35 paint job, see.
Oh.
And like Johnny Pajak had sent maybe 2 or 3 cars a week over to get secondhand cars and get enamel paint, not lacquer, but enamel paint sprayed on.
You had a spray can at that time?
Yeah. They sprayed paint on them. That's, I think, what didn't help Louis too much was he never wore a mask. He just inhaled that stuff, and I think that was half of it.
Yeah.
Trouble.
We probably weren't not aware of the
danger. No, all the danger was, I myself didn't wear one.
Yes.
And I run a lot of that. He worked in there just like he did, and it was, you couldn't see through the fog of the paint.
Well, after this, you held a number of other jobs. Have we talked about those?
Yes, we talked to like the Red Seal Service. I went there, and then I went in under Medina Parts, and we stayed there until, I was doing all the grease monkey work, and I got sick of it. Then I went up to Maxall in Buffalo. I worked there till that went out of business. And then I come back, and I got unemployment. That was the only time for, I don't know how many weeks. Finally, I got a job up there.
That would have been in about 1939?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked there, and then World War II started, and I got a 90-day deferment because I was working on government work up there, and they didn't have it set up right, or I'd have been deferred for the duration, but they missed it and they drafted me.
And you were about 38 at that time.
That's right. I was 38
years old, and you were drafted.
I was drafted, and at 38 they wasn't going to draft him anymore, and that's what I got out of the service after going through technical school.
Well, you were in the Air Force, is that right?
That's right.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was in what they call, I was at Scott Air Base, or Scott Field, they called it then.
Scott Field, where was that?
Yeah.
Is that Illinois?
Illinois, yeah. And we used to go into St. Louis and then out again to Scott Field.
I see. Well, it's a handsome picture of you here. My goodness, you don't look 38. Well,
that was before the heart attack.
Yes. Well, those things happen. But in... going along, you'd lived on Park Avenue
for
a number of years.
17 years.
17 years.
Yeah. George Carpenter and Lina.
You lived with them?
Well, they had their house, and they had 3 apartments, their own and 2 others upstairs.
Okay.
And we had rented one of the upstairs apartments.
You have mentioned having a heart attack, but before we speak about that, I think you told me when you and I were talking earlier that when Dr. Leone first came to town, you were one of his first patients.
Well, he come to town. He lived right on the corner. Well, he lived where he lived now, frankly, yes. In that same house.
Yes.
And if I got hurt or something or cut or something, I'd go to him. But we was skiing out here one night, and my friend cut his knee wide open, so we went up. The first place we went was right up to Doc Wheel. He come back, and he had a few patches on his britches when he first came to town. Just like, Doc Leon operated on me for a hernia. Mm-hmm. And we was always pretty good friends. His sons used to come down here when I had the business, and with their go-karts.
Oh, yes.
And I'd fix them.
Well, you said that you had a heart attack while you were at the Niagara Chemical. I believe you said you were hoisting some castings, alone?
Yeah, we had a half a ton hoist with the 3,200-pound castings I was moving. No help. And they were for brake shoe over here, after brake shoe had started.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden I got kind of shaky, and I went out and laid down, and it didn't do any good. And I went up and went to the nurse, and she says, "You want to lay down?" And I says, "No, I've tried that.
Mm.
It don't work." So she called somebody, and they took me down to Dr. Lowenstein in Middleport. He was on call for the factory at that time. He took one look at me and sent me to the hospital. And I was working on cast steel, and was I black. My hands and my face. And they took me in, they put me in bed, and nobody, not one of the nurses had touched me for 3 days to wash that stuff off, get that black off of me. Cast iron dust.
Is that because you were so sick?
Yeah.
Yes.
See, I was in bed 6 weeks without getting my foot over the side or the edge of the bed.
Mm.